So today on the Loopcast, I am very excited to talk about the situation in the Ukraine. As those who've been watching the news and following stories on TV and so forth, the Ukraine every day is changing and lots is going on there. So I'm very happy to have Andrew Mikta on the line, and he is the Senior Fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. And he is also a professor of international studies at Rhodes College. So thank you for coming on the show, Andrew.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So why don't you give our audience a general overview of the situation in the Ukraine right now? As I mentioned before, it just seems to be, I had a whole show outline put together, and then today when I turn on the news, everything has changed. So why don't we just sort of have a brief overview and look at what led up to the protest, which sort of seemed to initiate what has been going on over there, as well as the fighting that followed, and just give our viewers a little bit of an overview of the situation there at the moment.
Well, this is an unfolding story. It really has its immediate impetus in the decision by the then Ukrainian president, technically still claiming to be the president, Viktor Yanukovych, not to seek an association agreement with the European Union at that time. In November, late November, basically the beginning of the demonstrations against Yanukovych, just in the aftermath of the so-called Eastern Partnership Summit, European Union Eastern Partnership Summit in Vilnius, where Ukraine was expected to sign the association agreement. Why is this important? Because for a very large part of the Ukrainian population, that association agreement was synonymous with orienting Ukraine towards Europe and towards the West. Whereas, in effect, Yanukovych not only dropped that idea, but also turned to Russia and inked a deal for $15 billion in Russian aid, with the anticipation that this marks a very dramatic shift from Ukraine in the direction of reconsolidation of its economy with Russia, and probably down the line also some larger security agreement that Vladimir Putin would like to build that brings Ukraine in. The whole crisis really has to be seen in the scale of what's happening. Ukraine is really a nation of about 45, 46 million people. It's a huge country, and a country that's also not consolidated ethnically. It's a country divided up, and that's what's actually driving the crisis right now to some extent. And that is the fact that a lot of the people who are opting for the West, they're more in the western parts of Ukraine, western and central parts of the country. The people who are more in the camp now of Vladimir Putin's solution, that is what's going on in the Crimea Peninsula, what's happening also in the eastern parts in the Donetsk Basin, they're more Russian-speaking, more ethnically Russian. The majority of the population is clearly Western-leaning in this debate, but Russia, by inserting itself into the conversation, has dramatically altered the parameters of a debate. They've internationalized this. And this is now an East-West crisis of the first order, probably the greatest that we've had since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
And we keep on hearing about Crimea, and of course today it came out that Russia pretty much has taken over Crimea, which I think we should get to later on in the show. But we were talking before the recording, and you mentioned the question of why Russia has really dug in its heels into this matter. And we were talking about issues that happened in 2007 and 2008 with the NATO summit in Bucharest. So if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that and give them this build up to the situation at hand, that would be great.
Okay. Well, this is, again, a longer story. As I mentioned earlier, we tend to focus on the developments in 2013 and 14 because it's this most immediate crisis, but it has not appeared out of nowhere. We are looking at a process of really Putin's Russia, because it's very different from the post-Soviet period in Russian history, when you had an attempt to work closer with the West, seek some accommodation, and even cooperate. The Yeltsin era, when Russia felt both more pro-Western and also was, quite frankly, a much weaker power than it is today. Although Russia today has a host of problems, it is not a great power of the magnitude that we remembered. But in the relative context of Central and Eastern Europe, Vladimir Putin has been on this long-term project of restoring and rebuilding Russian nationalism and Russian influence, essentially rebuilding Russian influence in what quite often the analysts in Moscow call the near abroad, or what we refer to as post-Soviet sphere. That is essentially former Soviet republics, and Ukraine was this core of the Soviet state, the largest non-Russian Slavic republic. And if you look at the history of Russia, Ukraine has always been the pathway to Europe. And I would venture to say that without controlling Ukraine, Russia would never again be in a position of rebuilding the kind of imperial expansionist stance in Europe. So what's riding on Ukraine is one of the most fundamental geostrategic issues for not just Eastern Europe, but really for Europe as a whole and its relationship with Russia. So in 2007, we saw the first sign of Putin taking a step and putting the West on notice. He gave a speech during the Munich Security Conference in 2007, basically announcing that Russia would no longer accept the kind of Western priorities when it comes to this conversation on NATO enlargement, on the future of European Union enlargement, on missile defense, the whole host of issues. And then what was very significant that in 2008, shortly after the elections of Yanukovych, he has shifted Ukraine out of the pro-NATO track. Ukraine was at that time awaiting to get the so-called membership action plan together with Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, essentially a stepping stone to the full application for NATO membership. What happened was that, first of all, in Bucharest in 2008, during that summit, NATO could not reach consensus on whether to offer Ukraine and Georgia immediately this membership action plan, the MAP, for NATO membership. And instead, what was offered was kind of a longer-term, pretty nebulous statement that indeed, long-term, something to that effect may happen, but the immediacy was removed. Yanukovych then took Ukraine off that track. And if you recall, in 2008, Russia fought a very brief war in the Caucasus against Georgia, the war that to this day scholars argue was provoked by Russia, or the Georgians actually jumped the gun. It was over two essentially sovereign parts of Georgia, but nonetheless ethnically diverse areas, which the Russians used as a wedge issue, Abkhazia and Ossetia. And the Russians moved in to, in effect, defeat the Georgian army and, in effect, severed the two provinces from the Georgian Republic. Western responses were extremely weak. We sent a couple of ships to the region, but we did not have any sort of concerted effort to respond to this. 2008 is this critical jumping off point. It sets, in my view, the whole pattern of getting Putin ever more committed to put Ukraine in its sights, in his sights, and bring Ukraine into essentially two projects that he has. One is the so-called Eurasian Union, which is an attempt to create a common economic space that would be led by Russia. And the second one is his own new security structure, CSTO, which is it stands for Collective Security Treaty Organization. It includes now Russia, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan. And it is an attempt by Russia to create, in effect, its own security organization to push back against Western presence. So when you get to the present day, he seized the opportunity initially, hopefully, expecting that Yanukovych would prove to be a stronger leader and deliver Ukraine to him, in a manner of speaking, through these internal processes, first abandoning the NATO path again, NATO was not disappointed largely because of that. There was very little appetite to get Ukraine in because of the location of the country, the kind of set of problems that this would bring in relations with Russia. NATO was never in any sort of agreement or had never had any consensus on what to do on this issue. And then it appeared that Putin, simply by putting $15 billion down, could bail out Ukrainian economy short term and make it fully then absorb into this larger economic sphere of influence. What threw the monkey wrench into this deal was the Ukrainian people, the Euromaidan, which started as a completely unexpected kind of grassroots demonstration. And grew to the point that neither the Russians nor Yanukovych, most of all, was able to control. And if you recall, the denouement of the whole confrontation was when violence erupted and the Ukrainian government tried to use security forces, was beaten back to some extent. Yanukovych lost his nerve. The European Union tried to intervene to calm down the situation. There was a mission by the three foreign ministers from France, Germany, and Poland. Very briefly, a deal was inked, which is important today because that deal gives the Russians now another argument that they can intervene because the deal is not adhered to. But that deal was supposed to allow for earlier elections, possible constitutional changes down the line, and so forth. That deal pulled out the brick from the wall, so to speak, and everything collapsed in the process. Yanukovych escaped, literally escaped from Ukraine. He is now in Russia. He still claims to be the president of Ukraine, but you have a provisional government in place. You have the military and security forces that ought to be loyal to it. But unfortunately, both in Crimea, with Russian pressure and with Russian troops, we have reports there are about 16,000 Russian troops right now in Ukraine, including about 5,000 to 6,000 special forces in Ukraine, and possibly another kind of flashpoint emerging in eastern parts of Ukraine. So it is largely Russian pressure from the outside that has driven this, I would say, from as far back as 2007 and 2008. And we're now at this denouement where for Putin to back down, it means that his whole policy design for Eastern Europe and for the resurgence of Russian power will be put in question. For the West to back down, it means that the credibility of the NATO alliance, the ability to enforce some international norms, at least in the face of external aggression, all of this is now riding on it, and the lines are becoming ever harder and ever more difficult to reconcile.
And very much so. Going back to Yanukovych, I mean, we're seeing these images on TV of, I guess it was a CCTV camera of his escape in the night, packing suitcases onto a helicopter and so forth. And, you know, for a while there, they were trying to figure out where he was. And as you said, he's in Russia now. His going to Russia, what is that? That makes a statement in my mind. What does that mean for Ukraine and for Russia by him choosing Russia as his escape? Let's put it that way.
Well, it's extremely important in terms of how the Russians are framing the crisis right now. Keep in mind that Putin's position is that he is protecting the Russian ethnics in Crimea. He went to the Russian parliament to get the authorization to use all means necessary, including military force. And his response to whatever Western attempts to work out a compromise is that he cannot allow for what he describes as fascist, Nazi, gangster, legitimate elements. Every sort of vocabulary you can imagine is being thrown at the Ukrainian post-revolutionary government, the provisional government. He cannot allow them to continue because they have not fulfilled the agreement, because they're threatening the lives and the welfare of the Russian ethnics. And so forth. So it's clearly that Yanukovych is there both to provide this extremely thin, but not, nonetheless, this sliver of pretense that Russia is acting on behalf of the legitimate government of Ukraine, as Putin defines it. Of course, we have a new government in Kiev right now that is recognized by Western powers, that is recognized by the military, although there have been splinters within the military. We had the chief of naval forces in Crimea defect to Russia, and there have been some reports of other attempts to peel some of the Ukrainian troops away. But the fact that Yanukovych is there, it gives Putin this propaganda argument. And at the same time, you know, quite frankly, I don't think that Putin has very much hope that Yanukovych is able to deliver at this point. It must have been a tremendous disappointment to him that he did not have the quote-unquote backbone to actually use a military or martial law type of solution. And we know now, after the regime collapsed and he escaped, that he had the plans in place to use military and police to repress the resistance. So he is there in Russia as the kind of propaganda fig leaf, I would say, for Putin. But nobody believes seriously that this is anything but a Russian operation today, what's taking place in Crimea, and what may possibly, and that's the most dangerous part of this, take place in eastern Ukraine. We're looking at the possibility of the country in Europe, a major country in Europe, as I said, 45 plus million people, breaking up with the kind of realignment of rump states shifting in different directions. And once this starts happening, remember, we haven't had any serious fighting. We've had some reports of shots fired, but the Ukrainians loyal to the government in Kiev have been extremely restrained in their response. But once the fighting starts, and I think the Russians would welcome the kind of provocation that would give them the grounds then to launch a major military operation. Russia has 150,000 roughly troops now conducting exercises around Ukraine, and they just started also exercises in the Kaliningrad district, which is to the north, bordering on Lithuania and Poland. So this is an extremely dangerous situation.
And so Ukraine's provisional government, I mean, clearly they're in a crisis right now with everything going on. I mean, do they have the capability to deal with a situation like this on their own? I mean, it seems like they're pleading for international intervention. Whether that happens or not, only time will tell. But on their own, how strong are they to deal with a situation like this?
Well, and this is really the gist of it. A country's economy is basically on the verge of bankruptcy. The reason Putin was able to leverage so much for so little, quite frankly, I mean, $15 billion is not a lot of money in terms of state-to-state relations and what Ukraine needs. Is because Ukraine is on the verge of going bankrupt. It has energy bills that it needs to pay. Its economy has been deteriorating very rapidly. So Ukraine needs a major injection of funds to stand up again. And that's what the Ukrainians have been asking for. The requests that have been floating out there are about $35 billion in aid. My view has been that Ukraine needs urgent economic assistance, but something that would be reminiscent of the Marshall Plan of the post-World War II era, that is a very conditional, massive but conditional aid that would also bring with it Western assistance to help stabilize the institutions, build up the structures of the government, stabilize and modernize the military. I mean, do all the things that the country should be doing. The government is extremely fragile at this point. Putin knows this, and unfortunately, the West also knows this. The Ukrainian army is no match for the Russian army. It's a large army, but it's got all sorts of issues when it comes to equipment, spare parts, training, largely post-Soviet legacy equipment in place. In an all-out confrontation with Russia, and remember that the Russians are in the midst of about $700 billion military modernization program that Putin launched. It's a 10-year program, but we've already seen changes in the Russian military. It wouldn't be a fair fight if you're talking about a state-on-state conflict, and quite frankly, nobody wants that. Neither the West nor the Ukrainians. I assume Putin would like to have the fruits of victory without having to go to war, but an idea of an all-out military confrontation, in effect war, in the heart of Europe, involving Russia and involving people as politically awakened as the Ukrainians are today, it would simply get out of hand and beyond anybody's ability to control. I cannot imagine that even if the Russian military were to defeat the Ukrainian armed forces, which is very much, you know, in the realm of the possible, if you look at the balance of forces, that the Ukrainian patriots would give up. I think you would see resistance in the country, and you would see probably something akin to a civil war mixed with the remnants of state and military power, wherever it would survive, that would inevitably begin to pull in the border countries. It would present incredibly difficult dilemmas for countries like Poland, the Baltic states, NATO as an alliance overall. We're looking at the most severe crisis in military terms. And I've said this already a couple of times, but I want your listeners to really take this in. This is the most dangerous moment in state-on-state relations since the collapse of the Berlin Wall. We have not been in a situation of this level of tension, the stakes being as high as they are today, and quite frankly, the lack of unified response from the West to what's been largely an external form of aggression beyond the condemnations and expressions of outrage. Now, I will qualify this with one thing. Tomorrow, the North Atlantic Council will meet for the first time to consider the Article 4 consultations on Ukraine, because the instability and a possible war in Ukraine, of course, is of great concern to NATO members now. This is not just about Ukraine, a non-member country, but to the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, to Poland, to Hungary, to countries all of Central Europe, and especially those that are bordering on Ukraine.
Well, let's actually look at that topic of NATO's response to this. As you said, there's going to be this meeting tomorrow. But so far, what has NATO's response been, and what could their future response be to a situation like this?
Well, the response has been confused, unfortunately. There's been a lot of rhetoric, really tough rhetoric that has been coming out of both President Obama, various European leaders, from Chancellor Merkel through Polish Prime Minister Tusk. The rhetoric and the messaging here has been unequivocal that what is happening in Ukraine today is threatening the integrity of Ukraine, and that it is an unacceptable situation from the point of view of the NATO allies. If you listen, for example, to Secretary Kerry yesterday, I believe on Meet the Press was one of the shows that he appeared on Sunday. He accused Putin of state-on-state acts of aggression, calling it unacceptable, talking about Russia behaving as though it lived in the 19th century while we are in the 20th century. All of this is very unequivocal. The problem is that beyond that, there is little consensus yet as to what we should be doing. And let me break this down into two. First, let me create a hypothetical, that the worst were to happen and you would have some sort of a military response or a military hard confrontation. It is absolutely clear that Russia here is at a colossal disadvantage vis-a-vis NATO. If NATO were to determine, and I don't think this is in the cards, but if NATO were to determine to take a very hard line military stance on this, right? If you look at NATO, you're talking about a population of over 800 million. You're talking about a combined GDP that's 20 some times more than what Russia has. You're talking about the United States as the greatest superpower as part of the alliance. So we're not even talking about the same league. But in the context of what's going on, NATO is not willing, prepared, or ready to, in my view, make any decisive military moves. Hence, what remains in place is largely political responses. There's a lot of talk about kicking Russia out of the G8, canceling the Sochi summit, isolating Russia economically, freezing Russian account, cutting into Russian trade, extending the so-called Magnitsky Law, which would ban some of the Russian, oligarchs from traveling and living in the West and so forth. So all of these are really soft power responses to the crisis. And the problem with that is that as far as Putin is concerned, this is not something that to him, at least thus far, has appeared to be making any sort of significant impression on him. Russia is playing for a geostrategic advantage in Central and Eastern Europe. Until 2008, as I mentioned, the NATO summit in Bucharest, until 2008, if you look at the rounds of NATO enlargement from 1999 on, the three consecutive rounds, we've had this momentum of democratic and market expansion from Western Europe and the transatlantic community into the post-Soviet sphere in Eastern Europe, and also with the Baltic states into the post-Soviet state itself. That momentum was blunted in 2008 when NATO denied Ukraine and Georgia map, and then when the Russo-Georgian War took place, right? When the Russian-Georgian War was fought out, the Russians felt, in effect, that they took on NATO, and they ended by military power any conversation of further NATO enlargement. Today, for Putin, this is essentially about the greatest stakes for his policy of restoring the neo-imperial Russia on the doorsteps of Europe and making Russia a powerful player in international relations. I would venture a couple of things. What encourages him to act is that he perceives the United States today as increasingly a leveraged superpower, and it looks at the U.S. leadership as weak and indecisive. I don't think he has very much respect for U.S. policy today. Looking at U.S. efforts to reset relations with Russia, just as the Obama administration came into office, the kind of willingness on our part to negotiate arms control agreements with the Russians, and we negotiated the New START. We're trying to negotiate another deal. At least we're trying to have a conversation about that. And finally, the Afghanistan experience, the Iraq experience for the United States, the economic crisis that's been kind of slicing through the ability of the United States and Europe to maintain a strong military. Europe is de facto in the process of disarming, with very few exceptions. And if you look at the last budget that Chuck Hagel has proposed for the United States, we also have significant cuts coming, with a military much, much smaller than we have today. All of this plays into Russia's perception that the United States is a declining power, that because of our exploding national debt, because of our inability to get our political process going, he sees this as an opportunity to move forward. So the political responses from NATO, coming back to your original question, I am afraid will not be enough. For Russia to really have a real sense that we mean business, what we would need to do is actually do something very concrete in Ukraine. We would need to act in a way that would get a clear message to Russia that we're committed to the survival of this Ukrainian government, even though we recognize that probably Crimea is now a forgotten story, that Crimea is probably beyond redemption when it comes to Ukrainian government's ability to control it, but that we are committed to preserving the government in place, and that we are willing to actually do something very specific. And I haven't seen the sign of this yet.
And I mean, if you look at what is happening right now in the Ukraine, it's almost like Russia is using this as what I could like to call a demonstration war, because, as you said, there really hasn't been any bloodshed on the part of the soldiers entering Ukraine and also the soldiers on the Ukrainian side, which is a good thing. I mean, the news, you see accounts of the Russian soldiers telling the Ukrainian soldiers to put down their arms, and they have. They've kept knives on them, apparently. But, I mean, in that sense, it's good it hasn't escalated to violence. But, I mean, like you said, Crimea pretty much seems to be in the hands of Russia at this point. There also have been accounts that Russian jets are flying over the airspace now.
That's correct.
So, I mean, does this point to Russia pushing their troops further into the Ukraine?
I'm convinced that the game plan that Putin is playing for everything. Putin is playing for finding a formula that would allow him to destabilize and overthrow the existing government in Kyiv. And unfortunately, he is in a very strong position to do so, because even if we extend significant economic assistance to Ukraine today, let's say, just an economic package. And I will say a few words about military assistance in a moment, because I think there are concrete steps we can be taking to harden Ukraine, to make to create at least a form of deterrence when it comes to Ukrainian power vis-a-vis Russia. But in economic assistance terms, even if we don't provide any assistance, then it's just a matter of time before Putin can destabilize the country. I mean, energy supplies, trade, everything. This is not a very complicated affair for him. If we provide economic assistance, I would bet that immediately you would see an increase in energy prices for Ukraine. You would have demands for paying back the debt that Ukraine has to Russia. And essentially, it would be an attempt to further destabilize and siphon off the money that would be coming in, that should be going into rebuilding Ukraine, to go into Russian coffers. So this is the situation on the ground is such that for Putin, in my view, it's not a question of if, but when. Several things. Once Ukraine is seen, once Crimea is seen as essentially pretty much under Russian control, and I think we're moving in that direction. Most of the analysts that I talk to and people who are on the ground believe that because of Russian military presence, the lack of coordination, the unwillingness of the Ukrainian government to respond with military power, quite frankly, even though they declared military mobilization, they're not ready to do this in terms of equipment and stocks and everything else that they have. The next stage will be eastern Ukraine, Donetsk, Kharkiv regions. And I would also not be surprised if Odessa, the port of Odessa, wouldn't come online for the Russians as an important logistical pipeline into Ukraine. And then over time, I am convinced that he would like to see the collapse of the current provisional government, probably even greater turmoil in the country that Russia could use in order to bring all of the country, either directly or indirectly, under its control. This is, again, about rebuilding his position. Consider the reverse scenarios. Let's say that Ukraine survives this, that Russian plans fail. Putin is then looking at a problem actually reversing itself. I think we keep talking about Ukraine, but we don't say very much about what's going on in Russia itself and how a setback of that magnitude of Putin's strategy would play itself out in Russia domestically, to what extent Putin's position would be undercut by that, to what extent we could possibly see some movement finally to stop the creeping authoritarianism that we have seen in Russia under his presidency. You know, so this is not just about expansive foreign policy. It's not just about expansionism. This is also about protecting his own power base at home. So I would look at other ways of assisting Ukraine. I think that security assistance to Ukraine should become a priority for NATO, and that we should take steps to provide military help to the Ukrainian military. You know, we've talked so far about what NATO could do militarily. I don't think there is any likelihood that NATO would be willing, or that they would have consensus to make a decision to actually use its own military power. I think that's completely out of bounds, both for the public opinion in Western Europe and for the public opinion in the United States. But security assistance, as a military security assistance package to the Ukrainian military and to the Ukrainian government, I'm talking about anti-tank weapons, I'm talking about surface-to-air missiles, munitions, supplies, communications gear. This is something that NATO could provide. And remember that Ukraine hosted NATO exercises on its territory. For example, it has contributed troops to the NATO exercise Steadfast Jazz in Poland. So Ukraine. What I'm simply trying to say is that there are enough linkages, because Ukraine has participated in a number of missions together with NATO forces. There are relationships between the Ukrainian military and the NATO military that could be leveraged as these kinds of channels to start a conversation going about military assistance. We can deploy surveillance capabilities to Ukraine. We can help the Ukrainians with sensors and air-to-ground surveillance and things of that kind. And finally, we can put some military demonstrations indirectly into play, like deploying in the Black Sea and sending an unequivocal message that the United States and NATO are not going to stand by if there is an all-out assault on Ukraine. So by propping up the Ukrainian military, I think we may be in a position to slow down this process and give the government the breathing room that it needs to consolidate its power.
And if that were the case, I mean, what would be the time frame of getting such a plan into action? Because it seems like right now it's really at a red line point, I guess you could say.
Well, absolutely. This would have to be happening right now. And this is where I see the biggest weakness in the current state of affairs. It has taken a lot of pressure, especially from countries in Central Europe, to get the North Atlantic Council to actually meet and consider Article 4. We've had one session at the ambassadorial level. We should have. I'll give you an example. Secretary Kerry is planning to visit Kiev. He should take with him a number of foreign ministers from Central Europe and Western Europe. You should take the French foreign minister, the German, the Polish, and the United Kingdom as a message, a very powerful message for support. The Ukrainian government needs a clear sense that it will not be abandoned in a crisis, that even though the West is not able to come up with direct military action, that this is not in the cards. And I don't think, quite frankly, that they would want that. The risks are just too high for anything of that kind. But that when it comes to political support, economic support, provision of military aid, and just the presence, the constant presence of Ukraine in the debates of the transatlantic community, that is today extremely important. This is imperative. Every day that we delay sending this message to the Ukrainian government, the chances of instability grow. And every day from the other side, that we don't do something to really buttress Ukraine, we're sending a message to Putin that he will get away with his plan, and that over time, whether it's this salami tactic that we see right now, the replaying of the Abkhazia scenario, really, or Transnistria scenario, that is claiming that there are ethnics who are under assault and under threat, and then inserting Russian military power into it. With every day that we delay a clear response from NATO beyond just the standard condemnations, I think we're making it more likely that Ukraine will implode.
And then going back to the topic of instability, when we were talking earlier about the potential of Russian forces going further into Ukraine, so with Crimea, as you were mentioning, I know the Russian government kept on using the fact that the majority of the population in Crimea were Russian-speaking, and they had this affiliation with Russia, and it seemed like they had a very easy time of taking over Crimea. But these other areas in Ukraine, I mean, will they have the same easy takeover if that happens, or will we see violence erupt because of the locals there might not have the same affiliation with Russia as the locals in Crimea?
You will definitely see violence erupt. I mean, if you travel to Ukraine, you go to western parts of Ukraine, if you go to some major cities like Lviv, for example, you will see a very Western-oriented, nationalistic, patriotic citizenry that is a very anti-Russian and sees the current moves in Crimea as Russian efforts to, in effect, invade and rule their country again. One thing that we must keep in mind, because very often in the United States, I see this disappear from the conversation, that is, we don't have enough appreciation for the fact that Ukraine has been an independent state for over two decades now, and that this has created a new generation of Ukrainians. It's raised a new young population that is being defined now by its own national identity. This is a much stronger identity than what you see in Belarus, for example. And it's a very proud, very self-reliant nation in many ways. So if we get to a situation where Putin starts moving beyond, let's say that following Crimea, there is a decision to move in into Donbass, you know, eastern Ukraine, Kharkiv, these areas. Success, probability of success there are probably reasonable from Russian point of view. But if you tried a military move deeper into Ukraine, then you would meet resistance. And I think the further west you would go, that resistance would become more and more fierce. I would add one more thing. We may not see, even if situation unfolds as it is today, we may not see Putin move immediately in that direction. That's why I keep saying it's to me, it's not if, but when. It's the timing of the whole strategy and design. But there are other places where you're likely to see then similar developments take place. Moldova is another one where the Russians have been putting pressure. Georgia, which has now increasingly been drifting in the direction of Russia, and the kind of anti-Russian government that you had under President Saakashvili is no longer there. So all these, the next move may not necessarily be in the direction of the rest of the country. This may be then a period of tremendous instability. Remember, for Putin to make a move of that kind to consolidate Russian influence over all of Ukraine, he would need to have some regime in place that would be willing to do his bidding. And I don't think bringing back Yanukovych would be that kind of a solution. So you would look at the process of building this kind of ersatz structure, whether in Crimea or in eastern Ukraine, and then waiting to watch whether the west western parts of the countries will collapse of its own weight or will somehow continue to exist. But in either outcome, what we must keep in mind that what's happening is absolutely unprecedented. We're talking about a potential breakup of a major European state in, you know, in the 21st century, as both President Obama and Secretary Kerry like to talk about. And if we allow for something like this to happen, that essentially, to me, the conversation we've had on norm setting, on institution building, on the rule of law and human rights and the rest of it will essentially go out the window. I am concerned that we have misread Putin for a very, very long time right now. It's actually very dispiriting when I see American leadership talk about Russia with a kind of sense of disbelief that don't they get it, that by doing these things they're violating the rules, they're not behaving the way a 21st century state should behave. Well, this is a reality check. I think we should really rethink and reset our relationship with Russia here and recognize that we are in the world of geopolitical competition, whether we like it or not. This is what Putin's Russia is all about today. And if we do not respond in a decisive, forceful way, then we're going to see this accelerate. I mean, the Anschluss of Crimea, and I use this on purpose because it's got so many overtones of history. If it's unchecked, if there's no response, if there's no attempt to build up the Ukrainian military and to strengthen the Ukrainian government in Kiev, I am convinced will embolden the next move and will breed more instability in the region. And let's keep in mind that this is on the periphery of Europe. This is now becoming the new frontier of the transatlantic community.
It very much seems like these moments right now with what is happening is setting the precedent for the future of Europe and U.S.-Russian relations and so forth. Going to the topic of U.S. and Russian relations, what does all of this mean for further U.S.-Russian relations? Of course, they're quite touchy at the moment, but it seems like this could, of course, escalate it even further.
Yes, and what's unfortunate about where we are in this situation, and I think one of the reasons why President Putin has been emboldened to act the way he has, both in Georgia and now more recently in Ukraine, is that the Russians feel they have established linkage with issues that the United States in particular wants and needs Russia for. You may remember, we are now in 2014, so we're looking at the end of the ISAF mission in Afghanistan, but Russian cooperation was important, very important to the U.S. and to NATO during the ISAF operations in Afghanistan. We suffered, in my view, a very significant setback on Syria last year, at the end of last year, when President Obama, as you recall, set a red line for the Assad regime on the use of chemical weapons. That red line was violated. We found ourselves, or the administration found itself, boxed in on these issues and not wanting to use force, not wanting to back out of that very awkward situation. We created an opening for the Russians to step in as a power broker in Syria, as essentially the country that would protect Assad and to a large extent maintain the status quo. We reintroduced, to put it very directly, Russia back into the Middle Eastern politics by making that mistake on Syria, first of drawing the red line and then not being able to deliver when the confrontation unfolded. That the kind of backstory of Syria was the Iran issue. Russia has linked its cooperation and participation on the 5+1 talks on Iranian nuclear weapons to a host of other issues. I mean, you will see, I don't know how this is going to play itself out, but you will see very strong demands from Russia now, also on the ballistic missile defense in Europe, the demands that this be completely dismantled. Because Russia has believed the United States needs Russian cooperation on Iran, on Syria, on MENA region, the whole Middle East, North Africa region, that it felt emboldened to do so. And I quite frankly think also our pursuit of nuclear arms control with Russia at a price, in my view, too high, considering what the Russians were giving in return. The new START that we negotiated previously, and then the talk about the follow-up START agreement, the new START II agreement, all of these have communicated to the Russians that they have effectively linked American policy choices to their cooperation or the lack thereof. Now, after Ukraine, this is a moment of truth, I think, for the Obama administration to realize and rethink of what is possible in its dealings with Russia. And I think the first step to actually build a more balanced relationship, and quite frankly, maybe more realistic relationship with Russia, is to recognize that this linkage has not been very helpful for the United States. That because we have allowed Russia so much influence on these issues, and especially here I'm talking about the Syrian mistake, we found ourselves in a position where our own ability to pursue our interests have been circumscribed. I would be very surprised if after what happened and how Putin responded to repeated calls from President Obama, if the White House would continue to insist that we can do business as usual, or that we even can do business at all for a while with Russia. I mean, we will need to take a step back and reassess the situation before we make any other decisions that hinge on goodwill and cooperation of Moscow, because clearly our priorities are not being recognized in our conversations with our Russian partners here.
It's so interesting for myself, when I watched the news when this first all started happening with the protests, it seemed to come out of nowhere because my field of study is not Russia or Ukraine or Eastern Europe. And so now listening to you, it just seems everything has become much more strategic on the part of Russia. It just seems like all of these things happening are puzzle pieces that have been taking place for a long time now that are just starting to come together. So it's very interesting to hear this. We always like to give our guests a moment and an opportunity to maybe touch upon something that we haven't touched upon in the talk, to sort of wrap up the show. So I'd love to give you that opportunity.
Okay, thank you, Chelsea. I would add one subset to the whole Ukraine crisis, because it is becoming now an East-West crisis. And that's the larger transatlantic relationship between the United States and Europe. And I think one of the glaring problems that we see today, or glaring deficiencies, why is it so hard for us to come up with a common position here, is that I think this is a relationship that we need to reinvest in. I think both the United States and Europe need to refocus on this, on both NATO and the bilateral relationships between individual countries and the U.S. or the EU and the United States as the core security relationship for both of us. The reason I say this is we've spent this last half hour talking about Ukraine and Eastern Europe, but all of this is taking place in the context of the shifting power distribution on a global scale. You know, the United States talking about pivot to Asia or rebalancing or refocusing on Asia, which for us looking at it from the U.S. perspective seems like a logical response to the rising China, the kind of potential peer competitor and new geostrategically assertive China. But at the same time, it has sent a very, in my view, very negative message to our European allies about where American priorities go. And it has created a sense that for the United States now, the relationship with the transatlantic allies and the relationships in Asia are an either-or proposition, and that should not be the case. We have so much riding, and I say both the Europeans and the Americans, riding on the preservation of this open international liberal order that we've built since the Second World War. It's benefited handsomely all of us. I mean, in terms of peace and prosperity and the welfare, if you look at the growth and development that has occurred, institutional cohesion, the spread of democracy, these are real assets that we have generated collectively. And my argument has been over and over again that if we find a way to reconnect at these very fundamental big ideas between the United States and Europe, we will be collectively capable of addressing challenges like what you see in Ukraine, or the challenges that are over the horizon, what you're going to see in Asia Pacific, again, as a transatlantic alliance. And I, unfortunately, when I look at the last 6 years, and quite frankly, also at the period of the George W. Bush administration, this is not a partisan agreement, but we've seen either a kind of more of a transactionalism in the Bush era, and now we see more of a distance in the Obama administration era, to the extent that, you know, that's now being recognized as the United States being less and less present in on the European continent. I don't know if I mentioned this to you. I spent a couple of years between 2011 and 2013 running an office of a think tank in Europe. And at that time, I was struck by the perception of this growing deficit, transatlantic deficit, and the at the same time, the unwillingness, I think, of a lot of our political leaders, both in Europe and in the United States. This is equal opportunity. There's enough guilt to go around to recognize that these relationships are beginning to fray. We need to take the Ukraine crisis and what's happening now in Asia Pacific and use them, and what's happening in the Middle East, and use them as a wake-up call to understand why the United States and Europe, and especially the NATO alliance, are so central to the maintenance of peace and stability in the world and to our own welfare. This is a very national interest-driven argument. The kind of reaction, well, this is not our problem, and to heck with this or that country, that is not something that we should be tolerating today and accepting. That's probably the message I would like to leave your listeners with. We need to rebuild transatlantic relations so that when there is a crisis, we need to reinvest in them so that when there is a crisis like Ukraine today or something that may come up next in Asia or what's already happening in the Middle East, we can act as an alliance and act effectively.
Well, thank you, because that is a very strong message and a very important message. So I want to thank you, Professor Mikta, for coming on the show. And hopefully we can have you on again as this all progresses. Hopefully it will progress in a peaceful manner, but I guess only time will tell. But thank you once again so much for coming on the show on this snowy day in D.C.
Thank you so much, Chelsea. It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It was my pleasure as well. Thank you.
Bye-bye.